a lot talked about and has been for the past, well, probably 10 years or so in missional circles. The reason I'm talking about this is that one of the subject areas that I teach at college, I teach missiology and homiletics, which is what you call mission and preaching if you're trying to sound clever. So mission is one of the areas that I teach, and this is a word that I'm spending more and more time looking at and thinking about and wondering about. And so it did occur to me that it might be worthwhile just kind of exploring this a little bit with you, seeing what your understandings are. I know that these things are called seminars, but they're never quite seminars, are they, because of the numbers that we've got and the layout of the room. So I will probably, in an ideal world, have done this in a much more discursive way. But what I'll probably do is talk for a while and then stop, and we can just have conversation off the back of the things that I've shared, either if there are things that you want further clarity on, or if you've got a different perspective on things to what I've shared, it'd be fascinating to hear it, or examples of the kind of things that I've been talking about. When I find a phrase such as incarnational mission being used quite as much as it is these days, that's always when I want to then dive in and examine, well, what does it really mean? One of the things that frequently happens in church circles is that something comes along as an idea or a concept that takes off, and everybody gets hold of it, and a couple of years pass by and it's changed its meaning entirely and lost all sense of faithfulness to the original concept. Happened big time. Well, sorry, that's too critical, forgive me. It's happened to a significant extent with the whole Fresh Expressions thing. I don't know how closely you've been following that, but you come across people who think, well, we're doing Fresh Expressions, and all they're doing is they're having a coffee morning, or they're doing youth work, but it's not in the church, and they've lost sight of the fact that Fresh Expressions is all about starting new, independent churches in their own right. And it's simply become, in some circles at least, the latest way of describing any piece of vaguely imaginative outreach. And that's a shame, because I think the vision behind Fresh Expressions is fundamentally sound and healthy. And it's one of the manifestations of this notion of incarnational ministry. Could we just take the next slide up, please? This is the verse that you will often see referred to when people are talking about incarnational mission. Verse from John's Gospel, famous verse that we know, that as the Father sent me, so am I sending you. Now, that verse in its own right could be taken one of two ways. There's a kind of a minimal way of interpreting it and a maximal way of interpreting it. The minimal way of interpreting it is to sort of say, well, first the Father sent me, and now it's my turn to send you. As if it's kind of a chain, yeah? And that's perhaps a legitimate translation of the verse, that all Jesus had in mind was a sequence. The maximal way of interpreting the verse is that Jesus is saying rather more than that. That he's saying, in the same way that the Father sent me, that's the way that I'm sending you. And those who are wanting to advocate an incarnational approach to mission take that maximal interpretation. Because, of course, one feature of the sending of the Son is that it was an act of incarnation. It was an act of incarnation. That God the Son was sent as one of us to live amongst us in human form. That Jesus was God on human terms, was God in human flesh. You look at Jesus and you see what God looks like when God becomes human. That's the idea. So Bette Midler was wrong. God is not watching us from a distance. God has come and watched us from as up close as it's possible to get. And I think that's actually very, very important. It's one of the distinctives of Christian identity and should be one of the driving factors of our theology and our missional practice. So I'm inclined to go with that maximal interpretation that wants to sort of say, if we're being sent in the same way that Jesus was sent, then we're sent incarnationally. We're sent incarnationally. I said that preachers don't have children, they have sermon illustrations. Let me now prove the truth of that. Occasionally children are brilliant theologians, aren't they? My son Stephen, I was bringing him back from something. He was only been about 3 or 4. He'd been off with friends, I think, staying at a friend's house in the middle of Barnsley when we were in Barnsley. And I was driving him back to Wordsborough where we were ministering. And we had to drive past a Catholic convent. And there was a statue of Jesus outside this Catholic convent. And I remember Stephen sort of saying, "So, is that God, Dad?" I said, "Well, sort of, but actually it's Jesus." And he said, "But it looks like a man." And I said, "Yeah, that's right. And Jesus is God." And he said, "Well, so are you saying, so Jesus is like God with bones?" And I actually think that's not a bad bit of theology, actually. Jesus is God with bones. And the idea behind the incarnational missional thinking is that what God was doing in Jesus was itself an act of mission. Can you see how that makes sense? That this is God's ultimate act of communicating to humanity, communicating about himself, communicating about his love, communicating about the kingdom. This was God's ultimate expression of trying to draw humanity back to himself. And he did it through incarnation, not through an angel with a message, as in some expressions of religion, not in a dream, as in some others, not in a book dropped from heaven, not a prophecy, but through a flesh and blood presence. And the thinking of incarnational mission sort of says, if that's the way that God did it in the ultimate expression of mission, perhaps there are things for us to learn in the way in which we do mission. And perhaps too often in the past, our mission has been disembodied. And it's been too abstract and insufficiently incarnational. Now, of course, doing mission incarnationally because God did it incarnationally in Jesus doesn't mean that we repeat that unique one-off event of incarnation. You're not daft enough to think that, are you? There are one or two writers who are daft enough to think it. They think that the reason why incarnational mission can't work is that the incarnation was a unique and one-off event. Well, duh, yes. But does that not mean it can still form for us an example and a metaphor and an exemplar of what mission looks like when it's done supremely well? That's my point. It's not that we're in any sense reincarnating God, other than in the metaphorical sense of that, that Paul understands it's with the church being the body of Christ. There is that line of thinking there in the New Testament. There's a uniqueness about the incarnation in Jesus. But the idea is that it provides a fruitful metaphor. It provides an instructive example in how mission is done when it's done particularly well. Frost and Hirsch, who are two of the writers who've popularised this notion, say, incarnation was the missional mode in which God himself engaged in the world, and it should be no less ours. So if that's the case, what does incarnation mean for mission? That's my question. And I want to take you through 5, 6 simple suggestions as to implications of doing mission incarnationally rather than in some of the disembodied forms that perhaps we've been guilty. So if we can get the next slide up, please. Pictures a portrait by Lucian Freud, who's the painter who does human flesh better than anybody else. Takes the fleshliness of human life incredibly seriously and renders it superbly, with layers and layers of oil paints. So incarnational mission, first of all, takes flesh and blood seriously. Now, I have to put a little caveat in here because I know how easy it is for people to get the wrong end of the stick. Yes, the gospel is profoundly spiritual. I believe that. Now, you've just heard me say that, haven't you? Yeah? The gospel is profoundly spiritual. Yes, the gospel, of course, holds out a hope for us. There is more than what this fallen world has to offer. You've heard me say that, haven't you? I believe those things. Those things are important. But if we take incarnation seriously, we've also got to take the flesh and blood reality of this world seriously. If Jesus was sent, we cannot contrast the spiritual with the material, as if they're somehow separate categories, because in Jesus they're fused. The supreme spiritual being, God, becomes a fleshly blooded, embalmed human being. And there's something about that that says that matter matters to God. God takes stuff seriously enough to become stuff. And therefore, if we end up with a gospel that is all about getting to heaven, is all about having an internal relationship with God, we're not taking stuff as seriously as the incarnation indicates that we should. We're not taking the flesh and blood dimension of mission as seriously that we're meant to. Matter matters to God. Therefore, hunger matters to God. Therefore, ill health matters to God. Therefore, housing conditions matter to God. I mean, they've got to matter to Jesus, haven't they? For goodness sake, look at his job. That the physical stuff that's the more than just heaven, more than just spiritual, the incarnation suggests to us that that is significant for God. If we're to model our mission on the way of God's mission, then we take the physical realities and the physical needs of people just as seriously as their spiritual needs. Second suggestion is that mission cannot be done at a distance. If you could have the next slide up, please. How many people have tried to do mission remotely? In my last church, we just before I went, and after I'd been there 5 years, we planted two congregations. The second congregation that we planted was on a housing estate called Kettlethorpe, which had been built in between the wars. And I saw the original plans for what the Kettlethorpe estate was meant to look like. And it had this main road going down the middle, and the majority of the housing were going to be over on the southern side of the road, and then the northern side of the road, just across the road, will be all the community facilities, including a church building. But then Hitler happened, and so that never got built, and therefore you had this council estate of about 4,000 or 5,000 people with no church building on it. And we happened to have one couple who'd moved on to the estate. Our main church building in the centre of the city was about 90% full on a Sunday morning. That's not that impressive. It only seated about 120 people. But it was full, and there was no room for anybody else. You do know that once the church gets 80% full, you've got to do something about it. You've got to. So what we thought we'd do is repeat the experience of a few years earlier, and instead of planting out in the north of the city, we'd plant out in the south of the city in Kettlethorpe. And we talked about it, and my colleague, the same bloke I was mentioning earlier on, he took responsibility for the congregation in the north of the city, and I said I'd take responsibility for planting the new congregation in the south of the city. Actually, not a bad thing to do, that sort of kind of send your senior pastor away. To go and, because it says actually mission matters. The tendency is always to keep the senior pastor at home and to look after what you've got, and that's important, but there's something about sending the senior pastor away as well. So I became responsible for the church plant on the Kettlethorpe estate. And it kind of went okay-ish. Lots of church plants kind of go okay-ish, don't they? Have you noticed that? You know, that it kind of grew within about 18 months from a dozen of us to about 25 of us, and then resolutely stayed there. Interesting things happened. We ended up with loads of children coming along, so much so that after a couple of years, we finally had enough sense when it came to a Sunday morning that it looked ridiculous sending the adults out. Sorry, it looked ridiculous sending the children out, so we sent the adults out instead. We were meeting in a school, and the children stayed in the main hall, and we sent the adults out to the classrooms. But overall, as a plant, it really didn't work. There was a small church presence there, but it really didn't grow. I think one of the main reasons why that happened is that my wife, my family, and I did not move to live on the Kettlethorpe estate. I think that made a massive difference. He was an estate of people who were left behind. It was a poor estate, council estate. They got no facilities provided by the council. They were supposed to have them. They kept getting promises that they would have them. They never did. And here's somebody trying to plant a church and they can't even be bothered to come and live on the estate. There are probably exceptions to this, and therefore forgive me if I exaggerate in my generalisations. My only apology is that I'm a preacher. If you're not prepared to live as part of a community, you're not ready to engage in mission to that community. I think profoundly that's true. You can find exceptions and you can find good reasons, but there are not as many exceptions as we make. Incarnation takes presence seriously, living amongst. That glorious Eugene Peterson translation of John chapter 1, where the word became flesh and moved into the neighbourhood. That's the point. Again, let me quote to you from Frost and Hirsch: living out the gospel within its cultural context rather than perpetuating an institutional commitment apart from its cultural context. That's what incarnational mission is about. Not inviting the community to come to us in our special place so that they might be able to encounter the gospel. How un-Jesus is that? Not inviting the community to come to us in our special place so that they might encounter the gospel. Now, I'm ever so grateful that for all the people who have encountered the gospel that way. Don't get me wrong, that's how I encountered the gospel. I'm not saying it doesn't work, I'm just saying it's not a lot like Jesus. Jesus didn't plant a synagogue. Jesus went and lived amongst people. You can't do mission remotely. It's through the incarnation, Frost and Hirsch again, that people get to experience the gospel from the inside. Jesus becomes an insider rather than an unfamiliar alien. One of the delights of my ministry at Northern was an ordination service that we had that took place this June, July, where one of our students was ordained in a drug rehabilitation centre. Not for the sake of being trendy and quirky. Have you kind of come across that and wanted to put your fingers down your throat in church circles? Well, this is different, it's trendy, it's quirky. But because her ministry, alongside helping to lead a fresh expression of church in Manchester, where she works as a forensic nurse on behalf of Greater Manchester Police in the cells when people are arrested, often drunk, often drug addicts, and she works with them, has built a relationship with them, has built a link with the local Christian Drug Rehabilitation Service, which is now the standard go-to service for Greater Manchester Police and is now being rolled out across other police forces as well. And because that's who Jane was, because that's where she ministered, that's where it was appropriate to have the ordination. Do you get that? Can't be done at a distance. The gospel can only be proclaimed in a culture, says the Church of England and the Methodist Church. The gospel can only be proclaimed in a culture and not at a culture. That's the essence of it. Can't be done at a distance. Let's take the next slide. So this is number 3 of the 6. Now, as I said earlier on, if you're a principal of a theological college, you're meant to sound clever. This is my attempt to sound clever. One of the things that people who are advocating incarnational mission rarely do is they rarely dig into the doctrine of the incarnation and some of the theological understandings of what incarnation means. They don't dig deeply enough into that because there are various models of understanding this ultimate mystery of God becoming flesh and blood. You're never going to completely tie it down, but there are various metaphors and models that people have developed. And one of the models is a process known as kenosis. Kenosis. Not the local Greek restaurateur, but the process of emptying, of self-emptying. It's the Philippians 2, the great Philippians 2 hymn, that in order for God the Son to become human, there were elements of divine power that needed to be laid on one side. So the kenotic theory says there's something inconsistent and actually ultimately fallacious about the idea that even as, so for example, even as Jesus was lying in the manger, he was still omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent, because that's not what a human being is like. So as Jesus was lying there, wrapped in swaddling bands, he wasn't consciously aware of how many stars there are in the universe, or when Sunderland will next have a good season. He wasn't thinking of those things. He had to lay those powers of divinity on side. Now, he still was the Son of God. And a way of coming at it is to sort of say, what was he? He was a human being. Who was he? He was God the Son. Do you get that? but it's a process that is about laying aside certain human bounds. So that when Jesus did miracles, he didn't do them by surreptitiously reaching around his back and flicking the switch from human to divine, and then zapping the wine with a bit of divine, and then once he'd zapped it, flicking the switch back and becoming human again. That's not how it worked. That Jesus turned the water into wine as a Holy Spirit-filled human being. This is what is possible when somebody is as full of God as Jesus was. That's the theory. And if you take that theory seriously, it implies that incarnational mission has to be about genuine risk-taking. You can't do mission, this kind of mission, safely. You can't do it and stay invulnerable. You can't do it without running significant risks. It implies laying down security, privilege, position, authority, power, becoming vulnerable and trusting God that somehow, despite our limitations and frailty, God will reveal the divine glory. If the incarnation is about entering fully into the world, we need to remember that the one outcome of the incarnation was the cross. Vulnerability. It's a commitment to vulnerability and risk and danger. And the reason why the Kettlethorpe thing didn't work, the reason why we didn't move on to Kettlethorpe, is we thought it would be too costly. We didn't live anywhere particularly posh and grand. It was a tiny 1930s three-bed semi, but it was in a reasonable area, and it was just down the road from the church, and we weren't entirely sure we wanted to go and live on a council estate, a difficult council estate. I'm not telling you that because I'm proud. I'm telling you that for the opposite reason. I'm embarrassed. I wasn't prepared to take on the vulnerability that mission requires. We have a staff student retreat every year when our students, all of them from Luther King House in Manchester, from Cranmer, and from St Barnabas in Sheffield, with whom we also partner, we bring them together. One of the occasions when we gather and we go away for 36 hours together to pray. Roy came and led our retreat last time. And one of the things that happens there is that the leaving students get to share something of their story, and they tell what it's been like being a ministerial student with Northern Baptist College, and they tell where they're going next. 2 years ago, it wasn't last year when Roy was here, but 2 years ago, I found myself in absolute floods of tears at that point, because there were three people who'd been called to churches, and they were going to go to those churches, even though those churches, none of them could provide them with a stipend. Now, I went into ministry in those days when ministry meant full-time ministry. It didn't mean a lot of money. For goodness sake, it never has meant a lot of money. But it did mean you get a housing allowance. And it did mean you got to belong to the Baptist pension scheme. Which, of course, is a great blessing to us all. And here were two or three of our students, one married couple and one other person, and they were saying, God's called us to this place. We're not sure how we're going to live, but we're going. And I kind of thought, gulp. And I thought, hallelujah, there's hope. There's hope. And here are people with a commitment to the mission of God that put my commitment to the mission of God to shame. And so I did what I often do. I'm crying again now. Most Yorkshiremen from Barnsley cry a lot. Yeah. Fourth of the six. If we can move on to the next slide. If we take incarnational mission seriously, it means that we've got to stop thinking of mission as primarily an event, something that we put on and organise. Seeing mission as incarnational shifts us away from thinking of mission as an event to mission as life, from mission as simply saying or doing to mission as being. From simply saying or doing to being. Now, I know that Jesus said and did lots of wonderful things, but his words and his deeds arose out of his way of being. The fundamental reality there is he lived as human amongst people, and the words came out of that, and the deeds came out of that. And there's something about a model of mission that focuses primarily on organising an event and inviting people to it that's not wrong, but it's woefully inadequate. It's woefully inadequate. There's something. I think that needs to happen too. We need to waken up to the fact that that's no longer the way to do evangelism. We've been dominated by our evangelistic thinking in this country by a revivalist model that was shaped initially in the 18th century through the great Methodist revival in this country, and then a whole sequence of replications of that, where you had a big name speaker in a large auditorium, and what you did is you brought people to hear them. And I've done that. I organised Billy Graham missions in Barnsley. I was involved in organising them in Altrincham. I don't think that's the way to do it anymore. And I don't think it was ever a completely adequate way. We got away with it while ever the population at large was broadly Christian, because it's a revivalist model. We're not in a revivalist moment, we're in a resurrection moment. We're not bringing something that's become rather lifeless back to life. We're reaching out to raise the dead. So I think a model of evangelism that's not about big events, it's not even about alpha courses. Now, don't get me wrong, we did alpha courses for 9 years in my last church, and that's kind of okay, but I don't think it's where it's at. I think it's where... I've got this incredible theory about evangelism, which, if it wasn't so simplistic, might make me famous in theological circles, which is not that famous at all. Here's my idea about evangelism and what it's meant to be. If you've got pens, you might want to take them out at this point and write them down. If you're tweeting the gems from this seminar, here's one to tweet. Tell your friends and neighbours about Jesus. There we go. Go and be with people, live with people, and tell them about Jesus. I think that's everyday evangelism. We still might have the odd special occasion when there's an event. That's evangelism in its Sunday best. Evangelism in mufti is simply living life with people and telling them about Jesus. Let's still keep events, but let's put them back there in the background, shall we? Incarnational mission says that's the way to go. Fifthly, we're probably going to have about 15 minutes for questions and comments at this rate. Mission is not just about being attractive. For too long, as we see, mission has primarily been about come to us, be where we are, do things our way. At its worst, attractional mission happens when we've said when a church is simply far too comfortable to step out of its comfort zone. And people are increasingly disinclined to come to our events. Have you noticed that? Incarnational mission goes and lives where people are, in their place, responding in their good time to their issues in the name of the gospel, without setting limits. However, this doesn't mean, as it's come to mean in certain circles, that it's okay to be unattractive. The gospel is meant to be attractive. It can still be a stumbling block. What people's experience, I think, is often meant to be is they see something of God in an embodied gospel in the life of a community, a congregation, a person, and there's something attractive about it, but they may well have to cross a whole series of stumbling blocks to adopt it. There's nothing wrong with being attractive, and some incarnational missional speakers see attractional as being a bad thing in itself. Now, for goodness sake, I would that we were more attractive than we are. That's not a bad thing, but it's not enough. If we've got a magnet approach to mission, which sort of says, look how attractive we are, come and join us, we're missing the incarnational model. Incarnational model is a go to them, not a come to us. It's let me live with you, amongst you, feel your pain, feel your issues, share your hopes, share your joys, not saying come over here and join us. Let's create something where you are that fits where you are, that's in the shape of how you live, and transforms that into something that resembles more like the kingdom. So not just about being attractive. And then finally, oh yeah, I've done something clever with that. I'd forgotten I'd done something clever. And this is the other thing that lots of people who speak about incarnational mission forget. They're so keen to emphasise that incarnational mission is about being with, being alongside, being one of, being in the culture, being a part of, being like others, identifying with, that they sometimes fail to say enough about the fact that the only reason for being there is to be amongst people, but to be different amongst them. I worry that some incarnational approaches to mission are too embarrassed about distinctiveness and oddity and strangeness. Don't forget, Jesus, the incarnate one, was so different that he was profoundly uncomfortable, and eventually it got him killed. Let me take you to another model of understanding the incarnation. One is the kenotic model. The other one is the classic Orthodox Chalcedonian model, which says that what you see in Jesus is somebody who has got two natures. It's one person, but there are two natures. There's a divine nature and a human nature. Not necessarily the same as divine and human power, but divine nature and human nature in one person. And that reminds us that in dealing with Jesus, you're dealing with a genuine, full human being, but you're also dealing with that something else. That's something more. We kid ourselves about how easy it is to move into a community that's not ours and genuinely become one of those people. I notice that we've got a pastor here from the Philippian church that meets here. No matter how much I hang out with people and speak, I'm going to get this wrong. Is it Tagalog? What is it? What's the language? It is Tagalog. I got it right. Really. I'm never actually going to be fully Filipino. I'm just not. I can't be. Now, I can get a lot closer. I can learn culture. I can begin to put parts of the language together, but I'll still be something about me that's different. And actually, there ought to be something about us that's different in mission. There ought to be that godness that's different. We ought to carry with us the smell of God wherever we go. And if the purpose of incarnation is simply to be there and simply to fit in and simply to get alongside, but we've lost sight of the unique distinctiveness and the otherness and the specialness that the incarnation is all about, then we've got heretical understandings of the incarnation. Those of you who have not come across them might think, what on earth is he rattling on about? But I hope those of you that have read some of the stuff around incarnation or mission might recognise that I think that's a risk. That's a danger. Okay. I'm going to stop there so that we've got at least potential for 15 minutes to have comments, conversations. Do you want to take the first two of those minutes just to turn to your neighbour and sort of say, well, what did you make of that? What was he going on about? What struck you? Was there anything that you thought, oh, that's interesting? Was there anything that you significantly disagreed with? Just take a couple of minutes with a neighbour just to sort of kind of interact on that, and then we'll take a few comments and observations, and if you want, questions, and we'll have some reflection. Does anybody know if this water's fresh? It's the preacher's dilemma. I'm not going to risk it. All right, yeah, it might be fine, but I'm just not sure. It could have been there since last Sunday. Cheers, thank you very much. Thank you very much. That's great. Wonderful. If you've got that, that would be brilliant. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Okay, folks, let's turn our attention back to the whole group, if we can, please. Adam's obviously been very well trained in servant ministry because he's just come and offered to run around with a handheld mic if people want to ask a question so that other people can hear it more easily. So if you either want to make a comment or share an experience or ask a question, if you put a hand up and just wait while Adam gets to you, and then we'll give you a chance. So there's the first one, Adam.
I just wondered what value you would put on ministries undertaken through television, radio, and the social media.
I think it's important to be present there, because I think incarnation is about being present in every way in which humans are human. And one of the significant ways of being human today is by present on the internet, by presence in digital media, by presence in broadcast. So I'd want us to be there. And I would want us to be a voice. I think ultimately, however, it's not going to be our prime mode of engagement. And I think if we run to that as the replacement for our old come-to-us evangelistic services, we will still be missing it. Because whereas radio broadcast, television broadcast, digital media in most of its forms, I want to qualify that a little bit, allows for significant connections and frequent connections, I think it often militates against the kind of profound connection that we see between God and humanity in Jesus, and which I think we as a gospel community are called to embody. So important, but not the most important thing, will be my own personal reactions. I mean, I don't know whether others have got views on that. I mean, has Ian got an opinion? Is Ian here?
He's just gone.
He's just what?
He's just gone.
He's just gone. He knew the question was coming. Okay, not too. Is that okay? Yeah? Does anybody else want to make a comment, share an experience, or ask a question? Paul?
Thanks, Glenn. Fantastic stuff. Really appreciate making it clear to us. I'm still struck, though, by a lot of the successful, inverted commas, churches. You mentioned London and the growth of, I think, minority churches, yeah. And you could look at the Holy Trinity Bromptons or the Hillsongs kind of churches. And yeah. Primarily, their model of mission still seems to be attractional.
Yes.
And so some of us might be led to think, well, they're doing quite okay, why shouldn't we? And what is the issue about their way of doing attractional mission that seems to draw people to faith? Or do they need to learn more of this incarnational stuff themselves?
First of all, I want to be careful not to be overly critical of places like HDB and Hillsongs. I share your fundamental assessment, but I think it's possible to neglect some of the kind of dirty hands ministry that they do get involved in. They're not all about alpha services and former barristers preaching to poor little rich boys and girls in the West End of London. They're not all about that. Not all. I think they do it well because they've tapped into one of the dimensions of contemporary culture. It seems to me that what's happened to contemporary culture, by and large, is that we've come to value, on the one hand, professionalism, and on the other hand, intimacy. Those are the things that people are profoundly looking for. I think what we tend to have relatively less time for is that strand in the middle, which is neither professional nor intimate, but just amateur. And I think many churches are focusing on the amateur. Now, again, I could say a lot about amateur because there's all kinds of interesting things to do with amateur and the etymology of the word, doing things out of love. But I think in terms of connecting with society, I suspect they're very good at the professional, the slick, and I'm trying not to use slick pejoratively. Is it sufficiently incarnational? I'm not convinced it is. I'm not against big churches. My first church was a church of 300 to 350 people. but I suspect that big churches are only one small part of the future of the church in this country, and I've got much more hope and much more investment in the small grassroots communities that are going and being where people are, because actually sometimes it requires a degree of smallness in order to achieve the intimacy of presence. Come back at me if I've... Have I kind of addressed it or missed it, or were the things you were thinking of, Paul, that it would be good to hear about?
Yeah, I suppose for a lot of our churches, we're not going to be those kind of churches that we might look up to, and God is always calling us to be authentically what we are, and I think that's helpful, that we shouldn't just try to copy in a less slick way what other people do in their particular way. And it is about engaging with our local communities in the way that God calls us to, and that takes a different shape for every church, doesn't it?
So. It does, and I think one of the other things I thought about doing for this seminar, actually, but I've not sufficiently worked out my own thinking on this yet. You might think I've not worked it out on this issue, but I wondered about doing something about vocation for mission. Because we talk a lot about vocation in terms of individuals, what is the calling on my life? But if you work with the kind of broad understanding of the nature of mission that I want to work with, which is holistic, integral, includes a million and one different strands, if you work with the reality of incarnation that takes local communities and network communities seriously, then there's a really important job to sort of say for each church, what is God calling us to do missionally? What is God calling us to do? What is our vocation within the grand mission of God, which is universal in its scope? No one church can do it all. And so I think that business of helping congregations to hear the voice of God about what their vocation is crucially important. Yeah, crucially important. And you're right, very few of us will be called to be the Hillsongs and the HDBs of this world. By definition. By definition. I think we've got one at the back, Adam.
Just a comment, really. The other thing about these mega churches is they're pulling people in from a huge area. You can fill a big building if you pull it in from enough area.
Yep.
But there are huge tracts of land and living where people have no church. And they don't have cars and are able to travel huge distances to go to places. And that's the bit that can be overlooked and missed by these mega churches, I think, and where you need to get in there and do it.
Yeah. Again, I want, if I can, to sort of kind of give a kind of qualified response to that, because fundamentally, I agree you've put your finger on a significant issue. I knew a church, a friend of mine was pastoring it on a council estate in a northern city, where the church had worked really hard to be rooted in that community, to work with the poor in that community, to provide a whole range of services, were beginning to grow the church. And then one of the big sort of kind of house church movements opened up a mega church in the city, and some of their people were going round the council estate offering free tickets on the minibus that this church was now having to bus people from the council estate to the warehouse that the mega church was operating, and to see the way in which that church, which after painful, sacrificial, vulnerable, incarnational mission, then saw some of the people that were just beginning to join it and it was just starting to grow and get momentum whipped away because there was something bigger and brighter and glossier and louder and more trendy. I kind of felt the pain of that together with my friend who was leading that church. However, my qualification is we can't in today's society afford to think simply in geographical terms because our experience of community is not limited to geography. For many people in our society, we experience community through networks, which sometimes are spread out and extruded across big areas. So cities are a place which are both local and network, where we will often have friends and go to services. By services, I don't mean worship services. I mean things like health services, medical services, legal services, from a wide area. And I think we do need to be thinking about what does it mean to genuinely incarnate community in network forms of society and also in geographic forms of society, particularly because it's in the poorer parts of our country where geography really still does matter, because people don't have the resources to actually tap into the wider networks in the way in which some of the wealthier parts of our society do. So I kind of agree with you. I want to affirm that, but I want to say let's be careful and let's continue to be creative to think what does incarnation or mission look like in network communities as well as geographic communities. These two matches, were there two people competing there?
It's all right.
Well, shall we take both questions together and then I'll respond? So if you ask your question first, pass it back, we'll get the second question.
Okay.
Because we're down to the last 5 minutes and probably that might need to be it.
Yeah, it's not a terribly well-formed question. I just wondered if you could comment or say something on the connection between an ordained ministry and a lay responsibility within what you're talking about. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, yeah. But I might choose to answer his question first.
Very early on, you gave a rule of thumb when you said that if a church is 80% full, it should look to plant elsewhere.
Yep.
Would you say that was a general rule as opposed to releasing people to garrison other weaker, smaller churches?
No, I'd be perfectly happy with either. Perfectly happy with either. The only reason for referring to the 80%, and it's some old church growth research when they analysed churches that were growing and when did growth rates begin to plateau, and typically it was when the main meeting reached 80% full, partly because two things happened. One, those who were present started getting comfortable. Oh, look, this is nice. And those who were visiting found it difficult to find a place. So it was simply that. How you deal with that, I think we need to have a multiplicity of ways of dealing with it. And sometimes it will be planting something new, and sometimes it will be blessing other churches with other people. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Now, the relationship between lay and ordained, first thing I want to do is to register an ongoing level of discomfort that I've never quite managed to fully resolve about how we work with that distinction. I am working with it. I've been ordained myself, and I'm preparing people for ordination. So fundamentally, I'm comfortable with it, but I don't want simply to accept that distinction without saying there's something problematic about it. I think we need both. So I think if we rely on ordained people to initiate and to spearhead all our missional projects, then we're stuffed. We're stuffed. Because there aren't as many of us around as there used to be, and there will be fewer around in the future. Just looking at current trends and extrapolating. I'm not predicting, I'm not prophesying, I'm simply sort of saying if you extrapolate, that's going to be the case. So I think, as always, I think with effective ministry, an effective mission, if it's not primarily led by lay people, then I think we are in danger, and I think we're probably not being as true to our Baptist roots as we ought to be. However, my other big concern is that a lot of people who get engaged in mission are pragmatic enthusiasts. Now, pragmatism in itself is not wrong, and enthusiasm is good. But if we don't have well-informed contextual theologians working with the lay people, what we're going to end up doing is simply finding something that works and doing it because it works, without thinking through properly whether that's sufficiently theologically grounded. Or how do we take this whole tradition of theological understanding, 2,000 years of reflecting on the revelation of God in the church, and how do we reinterpret that for this situation and that situation and the other situation? So sometimes, tongue-in-cheek, when I'm talking with friends of mine who are arguing that theological education is wasted on pioneers, why would we make them learn Greek when they're going to be planting a church? I actually think it's probably more important for church planters to learn Greek. Because what church planters need is they need local theologians who are able to improvise on theology. The very best jazz improvisers know their music theory inside out. They know scales, they know chords, they know sort of different forms of rhythm, different structures of pieces of music. They know it inside out. And it's only because they know it inside out that they're able to then take it to new places in the act of improvisation. And I think unless we have in the midst of all our incarnational church planting, lay-dominated, lay-led, lay-rich, there are those there who are going to be trained and formed with a rich understanding of the Christian tradition to be able to guide and shape and help that, then I think we run some significant risks. Does that partly help? We are at 5:30, and I never like to overrun, so I suggest that we might call a halt at that point. Thank you very much.
You will have noticed that we missed our offering earlier on today. I'll put a basket for those that are going to go home, because some people go home at lunchtime. I'll leave a basket by the door, and that's what it's there for. But we will be having offering before communion later on. All right? Thank you.